I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. For a long time, domestic abuse in general was a subject few people wanted to discuss, and even fewer wanted to talk about it or even acknowledge that it existed in the LGBTQ community. The numbers, though, indicate it is a significant problem. We're going to talk about this today with Chris Hanberg of the Domestic Violence Network, Jenny Reister of the Julian Center, and Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Sergeant Dawn Higgins. Please join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or finding us on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Chris Hanberg, who's with the Domestic Violence Network, Jenny Reister, who is with the Julian Center, and Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Sergeant Dawn Higgins. She's a past member of the IMPD Domestic Violence Union Unit and a board member at Coburn Place. Well, welcome to all of you. It is good to have you all here. I think I'd like to start talking about, this is one of those areas that is doubly shrouded, because historically I've done enough reporting on domestic violence in general that it is something that people in the first place don't like to talk about at all anyhow. And then the fact that there was this other layer to it, with really the the steps toward inclusion, more direct inclusion of members of the LGBTQ community, we've become aware that, this is a problem for members of that community just as it is for just about every other part of humanity. So let's talk a little bit about the challenges of getting people to acknowledge and talk about domestic violence in general, and then we'll talk about the specific challenges involved with this community. And Chris, I'll start with you first.
All right. Well, thanks for having me here.
Certainly.
I think that people genuinely don't believe that they are in unhealthy relationships or violent relationships. It's hard to see it when you're in it. And so they may not realize that the violence that they're experiencing is something that is something that's not good. And so that, and then when they realize that it is a violent relationship, they may not know who to turn to. They may not want to talk to their friends and family. They may not know what resources are available. So that would be sort of my thought on it.
Jenny, I know you work directly, obviously,
yes,
with domestic violence and survivors. I'm not going to use the term victims. And in that situation, just from the reporting that I have done through the years, I know that there are all sorts of conflicting emotions that they bring to sort of the recovery process. Could you talk a little bit about that, about what it is that goes through someone, the head of someone and the heart of someone who is experiencing domestic violence?
I think one of the things that is important to understand about domestic violence is that it's not just physical. There are emotional components to it. There are financial components to it. A large part of how domestic violence works is control. So these survivors have been degraded and alienated from their support systems. They've been told that no one's going to believe them. They've been told that they are bad parents. They've been told that no one's going to love them. They've been told if they're an immigrant, you could be deported. They'll take your children away, those kind of things. So when they come to us, it's kind of twofold. First, there are the practical concerns of how am I going to find safe and affordable housing, which in Marion County is extremely scarce. How am I going to keep myself safe? How am I going to handle these legal issues that could be custody, divorce, support, immigration, anything related to that? And then you have the emotional issues. A lot of times domestic violence is generational. They grew up in a home where this happened. They have children in their own home. So they're really looking at how bad is this? We call it the tolerance for violence. If you grew up in a home where there was no violence and violence started occurring in your relationship, you might think this is odd. If you grew up in a house where violence was just part of the communication scheme, you don't really think that it's that much different. So the emotional piece of it is removing a parent from the other parent from your child's lives substantially. Rebuilding your own self-esteem, your own confidence, your own intrinsic motivation to move forward, starting to trust your own decisions. And we also offer therapy at the Julian Center for that reason. Therapy is one of the biggest things that you can do for people to kind of break that cycle of understanding that this is not your problem. This was someone else's problem. They did this to you. Now let's rebuild you and your children's confidence and your safety in your lives.
Dawn, I've always heard from police officers that actually they hate the domestic calls the most, that they're the most difficult to deal with. Why is that?
Well, I can explain that one of the things I like to say all the time is we're asking for simple solutions to very dynamic and changing, ever-changing problems. There are certainly things that are parallel in almost every domestic violence situation that we encounter, which would be two sides of the story, mm-hmm. And you children and things like that. So it's really, really difficult to sometimes ascertain who did what and in what time frame they did it. So those are difficult for officers, too, because they're very, very volatile. And what we try to do is train officers to look at primary and predominant aggressors, which are where we, you know, who started it, who started this situation or who initiated what happened today and who is more severely injured if they're both parties injured. And we're training to take advantage of neighbors, radio or phone calls that people have called into 911 and things like that. So we're trying to look at basically training our officers to understand that it's very, very difficult to ferret out exactly what happened in these situations a lot of times, but also to train them to encompass all the evidence that they can get, all the information they can get to make a logical, well-founded, and probable cause-based decision. And to top that all off, they're just volatile. And you have children involved. A lot of times we have pets involved. And we run into the same problems that Chris and Jenny run into, which is, what do we do now? Mm-hmm. Where can we put these people now? How do we get them out of their homes at whatever time of the day or night it is with the things that they fundamentally have to have? So, and that doesn't include, of course, the issues of whether there's weapons involved or how violent the situation actually was.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the issue of domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. What is it about these situations, though, that make them so volatile? I mean, as I say, I've done reporting on domestic violence, and among other things, there are the contradictory responses, the reluctance to report often. I think Jenny's alluding to the fact there may be economic and sometimes legal reasons, but there are also conflicting emotional reasons. It sounds strange, but just because someone is abusing you doesn't necessarily mean that you stop caring about that person, which creates kind of conflicting impulses about how you respond to it. You know, what are some of the other conflicts that go on in attempting to deal with questions of domestic violence? I'm asking this question in part so we can start establishing about how large a problem it is and the difference between what the numbers indicate, the reported numbers indicate, and how large the problem most likely really is. Jenny, I'll go with you.
First, it's important to understand that they estimate about 75% of domestic violence goes unreported. Mm-hmm. So the numbers that we have are not representative of the numbers that it's occurring to. The numbers that the statistics that the CDC puts out is 1 in 3 women will experience or have experienced mm-hmm. domestic violence, and about 1 in 8 men mm-hmm. have experienced it. So it's a high number of people who are experiencing mm-hmm. it. the issue is that they're not experiencing it alone. They're experiencing it as part of their community, as part of their larger family. You know, up until recently, probably the last 20 or 30 years, domestic violence was a family issue. Law enforcement didn't get involved. Maybe you left, maybe you stayed, maybe the expectations were that you stayed. We also have, in a lot of our clients' lives, the elements of religion. They're getting conflicting messages from their religious leaders of if they should stay or if they should leave. I think one of the things that people discount a lot is it's not bad all the time. And that's part of the trauma bonding that happens with a victim and a perpetrator, is it's these really, really good times and the really, really bad times. So it's not consistently bad all the time. It's these intermittent reward and punishment, where one person has all the control. It's very confusing emotionally to the victim. And then you think, well, if I can just get through this bad period, then we'll get back to the good period. The other thing that people fail to realize is abuse happens a little at a time. Mm-hmm. You don't go out on your first date and someone tells you that you're stupid, you're ugly, and then physically assault you. It happens a little bit at a time. Abusers are very, very good at, you know, gaining people's trust. They're very charismatic, typically speaking, and it happens over time. So let me see your phone. I just want to make sure that you told me where you're going to be. Well, who are you with? Why were you with him? I don't want you seeing that person. It builds a little bit over time. So you always have the victim always has that memory of how it was in the beginning. The other part that we hear a lot from our clients is they wonder how they're afterward. They wonder how they could have been so wrong about a person. And that's really hard to admit for anybody, let alone an abuse victim. Mm-hmm. Or survivor, is, you know, you dated this person, maybe had children with this person, maybe married this person, and they are not who you thought they were. How do you ever trust yourself or anyone else?
Your judgment. Yeah, it calls your judgment into question, too, at least internally it does. So the numbers here are pretty stark. I mean, we're hearing that the stated numbers are 1 in 3 women, 1 in 8 men. And in fact, they could be as much as 3 times that size. If I understand, 75% go unreported. That means only 25% is being reported. Yeah. You know, and those are really, really, really stark numbers. What accounts for the underreporting? Why are people so reluctant to talk about this, Chris?
I think people are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid of the way that society would judge them. I think that there is still a large stigma for being someone who is seeking services or seeking law enforcement. But also, it goes back to what Jenny was saying, that this is someone that you've bonded with. This is someone that you care about, even though that they are abusing you. And so you don't want to get them in trouble. The majority of victims that we've spoken with, or survivors that we've spoken with, they don't necessarily want the person that's abusing them to go to jail. They don't want them to have legal trouble. They just want the abuse to stop.
Is that what you find, Dawn, when you show up at those situations, is that they're going to tell you just about anything to get you to go away?
Well, in a lot of cases they are. What we find out is that we are somewhat, as police officers, there to protect and serve, as you know. Mm-hmm. And what they'll think is, here comes the knight in shining armor, so to speak, or in some cases, a female knight. But the point being is that we'll get there, and then
it's the 21st century.
Yeah,
it's okay.
And we'll get there in the middle of it, and we'll provide a resolution. And then because it's so fresh that something needs to be done right now, and they do want it to stop, and they may want the person to go to jail that day, they may not. But the fact of the matter is that then down the line is where we start finding out the reticence comes in, and the real clarity comes in, and the real starkness of what is going to happen here comes in.
How do you, when you're confronting that, how do you deal with it? Because a reluctant witness is not a great witness, generally.
Well, that goes back to what we were talking about just a few moments ago, is, you know, ideally, we're training the police officers to do the very best that they can to obtain all information available to them on the scene. And then that's where we partner up, with the Julian Center, with our advocates, with people in the community to help support this person, with the advocates from the prosecutor's office if we do have an arrest situation. So we try to provide all those things as they move forward in the process and hope that they'll stay on board with us. If not, and the circumstances are strong enough, the prosecutor will work with the police to help move that case forward as best we can.
Jenny, we're obviously getting close on time. What do they need, the people who are in that situation, who have been abused, what do they need to hear to reassure them.
I think part of also what we need to understand is why we say unreported, we don't necessarily mean just to the police.
No, I know that.
A large portion of domestic violence is not illegal. Being emotionally abusive is not illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So why reported, we mean also seeking help services. What they need to hear a lot of times in all those circumstances is, we believe you. And that's even for people who they go to in their own families. We believe you. We understand that you're telling us the truth. We're not going to question you or try to talk you out of what you're telling us. We believe what you're telling us is true. In terms of law enforcement, a lot of times it comes down to a safety issue, because this person gets arrested and is bonded out, and then they're coming back home.
We are talking about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. My guests are Chris Hanberg of the Domestic Violence Network, Jenny Reister of the Julian Center, and Dawn Higgins with the Police Department. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. My guests are Chris Hanberg with the Domestic Violence Network, Jenny Reister, who is with the Julian Center, and Sergeant Dawn Higgins with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So we've established here, this is a big problem across the board, domestic violence, and one that is made worse in part because so much of it exists in the shadows. And isn't something that we can talk about openly. Is it as big a problem in the LGBTQ community? And if so, what are the specific challenges that come dealing with that? Chris, I'll start with you.
Actually, research shows that it's a bigger problem in the LGBTQ community. And research is just starting to come out about that. But what we see is that 2 to 3 times higher rates exist between gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people for both physical and sexual assault when it comes to intimate partner violence. Why is that the case? I think that there's a lot of research to be done. But what I see from my perspective in my 12 years of experience is a deep mistrust of systems.
Mm-hmm.
That the historic hostility towards the LGBTQ community from society, from legislators, even from family members, kind of creates this
unresolved anger issue.
Unresolved anger, but you know, think about it. Now it's better for people that are in that community. Society mm-hmm. is more accepting. It's more in media, but that hasn't been the case until the last 5-10 years. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was definitely an us against them mentality, where people in the community were called abominations mm-hmm. by the leaders of our country. And so if you're hearing all of this negative messaging all the time, you're going to internalize that mm-hmm. whether you want to or not. And so you had no positive messages from society. You had no role models for what a good relationship could be. All the messages you were told were, your relationship is bad.
And
you are bad.
Yeah.
For wanting to be in that relationship. So I think because of that internalized societal negativity, people accepted less than great relationships that then translated into abuse.
In the interest of full disclosure at this point, I probably ought to say that I was the executive director of what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union at the time that the ICLU launched the first legal challenge to the ban on same-sex marriage in Indiana, so that our listeners are aware of everything involved. How much of this, Jenny, was, these higher numbers, in your view, as someone who works, obviously, with domestic violence survivors all the time, how much of this was a product of the fact that there was a certain kind of circularity in the argument here? I mean, I remember when I was at the ACLU, one of the things that they would, you know, that opponents of same-sex marriage would say is, well, you know, members of the LGBTQ community are just much more promiscuous. They're, you know, their relationships aren't as permanent and settled and institutionalized. The fact that, you know, obviously the law prevented them from institutionalizing
yes.
and making their relationships committed didn't seem to enter into the discussion. How much of this is that because at some level these relationships have had to exist outside of, you know, societal acceptance and really societal notions of what committed relationship should be has contributed to the problem?
I think it's a large contribution to the problem. The LGBTQ survivors that we've seen at the Julian Center, usually one of two large issues exists. One, they have shared property or shared children. Mm-hmm. And because up until recently there was no way to formalize that relationship through marriage, custody becomes a big problem because maybe one or the other adopted them. Maybe there was a surrogate. Indiana law had not caught up and still has not caught up to the different ways people can put together a family. The second piece is in the dating relationships we saw sometimes maybe one of the people were not out to their coworkers or to their family as being LGBTQ and the other person was. So that was a tool of manipulation, a tool of control. Do you want your boss to know that you're gay? Do you want me to tell your mother that
so
you're a lesbian?
So it's like blackmail.
Correct. Yeah. Emotional extortion for that kind of thing. And then all of that just goes back to what we talked about with the domestic violence. So you already have a abuse situation that's underreported, and then you have a lot to lose. Perhaps you have your job. Perhaps you have your children. We've had LGBTQ survivors come to the Julian Center who have flat out said, I will stay in this relationship till the day I die before I leave my children alone with this person. I'm not risking that. People underestimate the protections of marriage in the marriage equality conversation. They think it's just going up and having a wedding and being married. If you're not married, you can't have a divorce. You can't have a divorce. A court can't decide what's best for your children.
For custody and
correct.
All of that.
Mortgages, all those things that you don't think about as in a heteronormative cisgender marriage. Those protections were denied to that community.
Dawn, what are the specific challenges that come being a law enforcement official when you're dealing with LGBTQ cases of domestic violence, and more specifically, the fact that, as Jenny's pointed out, there still are some significant gray areas when it comes to our unexplored areas in the law.
There are a lot of unexplored areas of the law. In fact, interestingly, with this paternity/parenting, we're still fighting out. You know, there are situations where we're having same-sex families with donor egg carrier, but who actually has any legal proprietary interest in the child, so to speak, when it comes to medical things and things like that. So that's a huge issue for us sometimes on runs is trying to figure out, number one, what kind of a relationship do we actually have here? Because sometimes, again, they're not going to say it. They're not going to come forward, especially it's still a male-dominated profession. Men and women that are in same-sex relationships are afraid of the police and institutions, like both Jenny and Chris have pointed out. And the fact that we, unfortunately, sometimes still see these as fights.
Mm-hmm.
The dynamic of it being a domestic violence situation or a family violence situation is not very clear sometimes to officers. And I think officers, in fact, well-intentioned or not, are sometimes afraid to say the words. Mm-hmm. And we have to say the words. It's no different than when we have to be specific in a sex crimes assault. You know, were you raped or were you sodomized or did this happen or did that happen? It's the same thing in these situations. We've got to break down the barriers of being afraid of asking the questions that are important, because if that person that's in a situation such as LGBTQ and they actually make that step to call law enforcement, they are going to have to they've really, really gotten over some burdens. They've really said, it's that bad. And so we continue to train to that, and we continue to remind officers to ask those pointed questions to make sure that we know what's going on so we can provide the right references, the right resources, the right support, and the right reactions from the police department.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Tracy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Tracy, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
I am not a member of the LGBTQ community, but I'm a domestic violence survivor, so I first just wanted to thank you all for everything that you do for survivors like me. My question is, I was in college when my relationship happened, and I wasn't really aware of the resources that were available to college students in situations like mine, so I was just wondering if maybe you could talk about the resources that are available for those in the LGBTQ community and those not when domestic violence situations come up.
Very good question. Thank you very much for the call, Tracy, and thank you
thank
for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. Well, we probably should talk about resources. We probably also should start by, if you are in a situation like that and you want, you know, gay, straight, anywhere along the line, if you're in a bad situation and you need help, how should you go about getting it?
Okay. You know, obviously, if you are in immediate danger, we encourage everyone to call 911, get law enforcement involved, keep yourself safe. If you are more interested in receiving services or just asking questions, you can always call the Julian Center. Our 24-hour crisis line is 920-9320.
Please give that to them again.
317-920-9320. If you Google Julian Center, it comes up as well. The Julian Center kind of has a reputation for being just a shelter, but we actually have a huge array of outreach services. We actually serve 2-to-1 the number in outreach that we do in shelter. So if you just have questions, call us. We'll get in touch with you. We serve everybody. We don't discriminate on gender identity, sexual orientation, religion, age. We will talk to anybody. There are other organizations in town that have the same services. Salvation Army Social Service Center has them. Families First has them. You can always call 211, which is the main number, mm-hmm. and they will get you connected to where you need to go. But one of the things I really want to encourage any survivor, anyone who's experiencing violence, is even if you're not ready to leave, give us a call. We'll talk you through kind of what your options are, what things might look like, safety planning. Sometimes we literally get phone calls from someone who says, I don't know if I'm in an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. I think I am, but he or she has never hit me. Mm-hmm. And so we have that whole conversation. Mm-hmm. So that would be the first thing that I would really encourage people to do. In terms of the LGBTQ community, this actually is a big problem. Outreach to that community mm-hmm. has been lacking mm-hmm. among all service providers, I would say, in Marin County. And actually in 2013, the Julian Center founded the Service Equality Task Force to respond to that. And since then, we've been joined by 8 or 9 other organizations for the endorsement part of it.
We're up to 11 now.
We actually put together a list of best practices to include LGBTQ services and make it a welcoming environment for LGBTQ staff in those environments. And part of that big thing is just recognizing service providers have done a poor job of reaching out to this community, partially because the community has a large distrust of systems, as we've talked about, but partially because service providers just tried to apply the same services that we give to heterosexual cisgender clients, and that's not always the best option. So now we're offering more training. Chris at DVN offers a fantastic training on being more comfortable with LGBTQ populations, unique barriers mm-hmm. they experience. The last 4 years, the Service Equality Task Force has had a table at Pride, mm-hmm. and that's been a huge proponent of how getting the services out, because we get people all through the year say, oh yeah, I saw your table at Pride. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we've recently been doing more work with the Rainbow Chamber of Commerce, and Indy Pride is offering their first educational session on domestic violence next week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's March 3rd at the Damien Center, and okay. you can go on the Indy Pride webpage or Facebook page and look at the event. But we've been working with several agencies to update their policies, procedures, to train staff. And now we're entering into the outreach phase mm-hmm. Of this program through the Service Equality Task Force of reaching out to the community and letting them know what services were available. we surveyed the community for about a year, did online surveys and focus groups, and we found two things. The first thing we found is the majority of people didn't know what services were available if they'd experienced sexual assault or physical violence or domestic violence, dating abuse. And so, and then the second thing we learned was that those who were aware had a very poor opinion. As Jenny said, they tried to apply the same solutions for heterosexual couples to this community without really understanding the unique dynamics.
Dawn, I want to pick up on something that actually Jenny said, that if you're in immediate danger, you should call 911. I'm sure, given the numbers, that there are people out there who are listening right now to this show, probably are not in immediate danger, but they know that they could be at some point, that they're in these kind of dangerous relationships, and it's only... If they call 911, what is the kind of information that is helpful to law enforcement officials to get in that initial contact so that they know how to structure that that call as quickly as possible? Because often they don't have a whole lot of time to make it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously we want to know who's in danger, who's involved, who's in the house, weapons involved. Is anyone already injured? Do we need to send medical help? Is anyone actually being held captive, for example? Because there are times where someone may be calling us and they feel like they can't get out of the house. And actually the devil's in the details in that, too, because sometimes people are not being physically constrained, but they believe, in fact, that they cannot get out. So those types of questions are very, very important for us to be able to have answered when a 911 call is received at the dispatch center. Just, again, follow the guidelines of what the dispatcher might ask, and they're trained to ask those questions as well. You know, what's going on today? Do you need help? Do you need an ambulance? Again, are children in the home? Where are the children? And continuing just to find out what things are involved that might have to do with immediate safety of everybody involved, not just the police.
Gotten an email question from a listener who prefers not to be identified for obvious reasons, who says, and I should say, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org, says, I'm a recent survivor of domestic violence. I'm so grateful for your show today. I'm not LGBTQ, but a survivor as well. I do realize the purpose of today's unique program, though, and thankfully have found safe refuge. To my knowledge, the perpetrator remains in the area where the attack occurred. Might your panel be able to expound on what might delay the process in executing arrest warrants? Thank you for the time. And the subject line is, once charges are filed by the prosecutor's law office, how long can it take to arrest the perpetrator? Dawn.
Certainly. Well, right now, when there is a domestic violence incident reported and it's a police report and it moves through the system, we'll get it assigned to the domestic violence unit. And they're like every other thing. They have to triage certain things. So they're assigned to detective. Detectives then finish up the investigative process, meet with the prosecutor, and then walk the warrants down. Now, unfortunately, there's sometimes at the prosecutor's office, we have it may be slower than faster, but ideally you want to get those warrants out within a day or two, if at most, if there's not an on-site arrest, and up to a couple of weeks, depending upon how fast the system's actually working. Again, we're talking about a system, unfortunately. But then once we get the warrant, that information is usually pretty quickly dispatched and or available in computer for us to run those people. So I would continue, though, to say this, because the volume of things that happen in the city, if you have someone that you're working with that's an advocate or detective, stay in touch with them and continue to ask them the questions that you need to have asked. We train people, I know Jenny and Chris do, that the best person to tell you how much danger they're in is the person who's in danger. It's not me coming out looking in. It's them living in it. So we actually need them to continue to work with us on those situations. But I would encourage this person to talk with the detective assigned to their case and continue to follow up as well. But we try to get them done as fast as we can, and hopefully within a day or two.
And I'd also just
real
like,
quickly, Jenny,
yeah, just like to say that you can receive services from any social service agency independent of how the police investigation is going or if you called the police. The Julian Center is really fortunate to have a really good relationship with IMPD, so our advocates a lot of times can help victims make those connections with IMPD and the prosecutor's office. But please don't think services are dependent on that. Services are available.
Very correct.
We are talking about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. My guests are Chris Hanberger, the Domestic Violence Network, Jenny Reister of the Julian Center, and IMPD Sergeant Don Higgins. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community. My guests are Chris Hanberg of the Domestic Violence Network, Jenny Reister with the Julian Center, and IMPD Sergeant Dawn Higgins. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. We've gotten a comment from a listener who did not wish to go on the air. Says this is an important conversation whether you are part of the LGBTQ community or heterosexual. Caller wanted to comment further why anyone doesn't want to report domestic violence. There is a lack of self-confidence and a lot of self-doubt. Sometimes you question yourself and wonder if you are just crazy. I mean, that's the other part of this, Jenny, I think that you alluded to, and Chris as well, is that it diminishes the sense of self that a person has. It attacks your sense of self-worth. I want to pivot, though, because as we've said, there has been a historic change in the past 5 to 10 years. Again, full disclosure, in my time as executive director of the ACLU, I would see the polling data and focus group stuff on acceptance of the idea of same-sex marriage or same-sex relationships in general or acceptance of the LGBTQ community. And 15 years ago, the opposition was so high it was almost radioactive. Now a majority of Americans, obviously support these relationships and don't see them as necessarily problematic. Has that helped the situation in regard to domestic violence in the LGBTQ community? And I want to go to the second part. Is some of what we're seeing, if there is, I remember, you know, at the time of like the Tyson rape trial and the and William Kennedy Smith, we saw actually that the reporting of rape began to escalate in part because it had come out of the closet as well. Are we seeing somewhat the same dynamic? Jenny?
We are seeing, well, let me back up. We were seeing higher reporting rates, and then after RFRA, they've declined again. Unfortunately, the LGBTQ community is confused about what RFRA, if they can call people for help in Indiana, mm-hmm. if they will be received well. One of the reasons that we did this endorsement process was to keep a list of people that we know will serve them. It's on DVN's website at www.dvnconnect.org. There is a list of organizations who are more than happy to serve LGBTQ survivors and people with questions and support people for LGBTQ communities. So I would say yes. Oh, I've been doing this about 12 years, 13 years. We definitely see more reporting, but I will say between when DOMA was overturned, we kind of hit a peak. And then soon after, RFRA was introduced, and it started somewhat of a decline, which is unfortunate. A lot of the work that Chris and I do is to kind of thwart that public opinion of, I don't know if I call the Julian Center or DVN or whoever, if I'm going to be allowed to get services there. But that's definitely had an effect in our area. Nationally, I think the calls are up. Mm-hmm. Just knowing anecdotally around the nation, I think in our state we're a little unique because of the current political climate here.
You know, I do think the overturning of DOMA did have an effect because if you think about our culture, it seems that when we talk about relationships, marriage is always, for heterosexuals, it's always the end goal. You know, high school kids, college kids, it's always thinking about marriage. People in same-sex relationships didn't have that option. And mm-hmm. so it was sort of the road to nowhere in society's mm-hmm. mind. Now that there is the marriage option, I think that it gives more stability and, I hate to say it, credibility to their relationships. It gives more...
also gives a lawful contract.
Yeah, absolutely.
Construct to it, too. Legal construct as well. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Lindsay, and if you'd like to find us on Twitter, You can do so at WFYI or on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Lindsay says, may teenagers in the LGBTQ community who experience teen dating abuse use the same resources you have mentioned. Are these age-specific in any way, Jenny?
The Julian Center, we do serve teen victims of dating violence. We are actually in the process of developing a program specifically for teen dating violence in general, not just LGBTQ teens. So those services are absolutely available to them. We also find that LGBTQ teens, much like adults, are involved in violent relationships at higher rates because a lot of times LGBTQ teens haven't really embraced their own sexual orientation or their own gender identity. Mm-hmm. They're kind of working their way through. That's a confusing time. So when we get back to this kind of black male forced outing conversation around that, that's a bigger deal for teens. Social groups are a big deal for teens. And a lot of our teens that we find, their parents don't know. Mm-hmm. So how do you go to your parents for help? You're like, oh, I'm in an abusive relationship, and by the way, I am bisexual or lesbian or gay, or I think I might be transgender. So it's really important for teens to access services.
Does that make the legal reporting requirements, when they ask for services, somewhat dicey because they're minors? They're not legally responsible themselves. Right?
Chris can answer this more, Chris. But as long as the the person who is abusing them is also a minor and not related to them, we can treat them similar to how we treat adult.
Chris.
Yeah, we did some work with the Department of Education here in Indiana and spoke with several attorneys in the Attorney General's office, and the consensus was that as long as they are a minor, that they're being physically assaulted just physically assaulted by a peer.
Or emotionally abused.
Then there is no reporting requirement. If sexual violence is involved, it is mandatory reporting, or if it's by someone that is over the age of 18. But I also wanted to say that teenagers can find resources at loveisrespect.org. Mm-hmm. They have advocates on 24/7 to chat with, and they don't ask any identifying information. It's just simply someone that you can talk to see if your relationship is abusive. Or you could type love is, text that to 22522.
Go ahead and give them the URL and the texting information again.
It's loveisrespect.org.
Okay.
And 22522, texting love is.
Okay. And we've gotten an email question from a listener named Anthony. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Anthony says, Mr. Hamburg makes a great point about the LGBTQ community's distrust of systems and societal leaders in general. Things have, in fact, improved exponentially over the last 5 to 10 years, but our state laws are still catching up to provide proper protections for LGBTQ people and still have a long way to go. But what things are being done within the police force to reach out to the LGBTQ community, specifically to build that trust? Are there any official programs or initiatives? How can anyone in the LGBTQ community be assured responding police officers will be unbiased and protect them in domestic violence situations without there being interference from their personally held views and politics against LGBTQ rights in general? Dawn, I think that's one you get to answer.
Boy, that's a big one, too.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's actually an excellent question. You know, obviously, we have a 1,600-member police department, so I could never sit here and say, well, every single officer is going to do every single thing the same way, nor do we all have the same beliefs. But we are predicated on being fair and equitable and providing the best service possible to all the citizens of the community. So with the belief that we are doing that, I would say you should go ahead and report. And then if there is something that doesn't meet the criteria or your expectation of what you think the police should do or the law enforcement community or the criminal justice system should do, then follow the appropriate procedures to get in touch with someone who can assist with that. As of right now it's kind of a grassroots thing. I've worked greatly with Chris and Jenny and the Julian Center and the Coburn Place. And so I've been writing notes during the course of this radio show to get myself back and talk with some people about maybe getting Chris in to talk with our recruits and things like that. So I'm a field supervisor. I don't really do the training part of it right now, but I do think that walking away from from this. I've got some things that I'm thinking of, and we're going to move forward on that. But in the meantime, you know, my expectation is you're going to be treated appropriately and fairly. If that does not happen for some reason, please be sure to get a hold of either a supervisor of the individual involved or get a hold of our Citizen Complaint Office. I'm not asking you to complain. I'm trying to be proactive here. But just to let you know that there are checks and balances in our system, and we have a wonderful new chief of police and a new mayor that I think are really looking at being more outreach in the community. So I see us moving forward much more positively as we move forward in this new administration to get some of these things worked on.
Chris, how large a problem is this that Anthony alludes to? The fact that if you make a call, if you're part of the LGBTQ community, what Anthony is arguing here is often you feel like, okay, I'm in a bad situation already. This is a great way to make it worse.
Well, if full disclosure, I worked through the Julian Center with IMPD as a direct service provider for about 10 years.
Okay.
And my experience with officers was really, really positive. I have a lot of respect for IMPD and for the sheriff's office. They do great work. That being said, in all fairness, the officers that would call advocates to the scene are the ones that would be good, are the ones that would treat people with quality, fairness, and respect. I think that it's gotten better. I've certainly worked with clients that were arrested with their abuser, which is one of the things that we see nationally in data, is that officers have a hard time deciding or distinguishing between perpetrator and victim. And so both people go to jail because they view it as a fight or mutual combat. I will say that IMPD, we do have a great relationship with them, and we're planning some training this spring through the Service Equality Task Force and the Julian Center to look at these issues.
The other piece of it is that, just as kind of a plug, if you are a law enforcement agency located in Central Indiana, the Julian Center or DVN will be happy to come out and do training. And we are both certified by ILEA, so we can offer credit hours. So please just go online to one of our websites, and we'll be happy to come out and do any kind of education for sworn police officers or prosecutors, and they can get their training credit hours in. The other thing is that once again, working with an advocate, we've had clients come to us and say, you know, the officer came out and he or she wasn't mean to me, but I don't think they understand why what they said was offensive. So we've been able to then go to IMPD or Beach Grove or Southport or Speedway or wherever and say, hey, we don't want to get this officer in trouble. We just want them to understand why what they said in that moment, even though they didn't mean it that way, wasn't okay. So once again, working with an advocate who can kind of make those connections is really important. Obviously, what Sergeant Higgins said about if you feel like your rights were violated or things were not handled appropriately, IMPD and the mayor's office both have lines for that.
Yes.
And I'd like to throw out also, if you're the victim of a crime in Indiana, there's a Bill of Rights for you. You have certain rights as a victim of a crime, of any crime, that we have to abide by as citizens, and we are to provide you with the victim information card. So keep in mind that this isn't just a situation where an officer or some other law enforcement entity, they can just whimsically go and do whatever. They have to provide these victims' rights information to you so that you know what your rights are as a victim in the state of Indiana. So those things should be provided to a victim of a crime here
and
through IMPD.
You can also, on the Julian Center website, we actually have a video about victim rights in Indiana that apply to all victims of crime. I think it's 12 minutes long. It's not that long. If people want to go on juliancenter.org and watch it and just learn more about victim rights in general.
Gotten an email from a listener named Allie. If you'd like to find us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, I used to facilitate domestic violence groups for men and women at a mental health agency. I recall having a client who was gay in one of the groups, needing to complete a 26-week batterers group. He actively hid his sexuality within the group because I believe he was fearful of the other men knowing. How can we provide better services in which LGBTQ individuals who need therapy or group services but are fearful to be honest and engage for fear of discrimination or even physical harm? I think probably, Jenny, I'll go with you on that one.
Well, I think the question she's asking is actually two questions. Therapy for survivors is much different than a batterers intervention program. Mm-hmm. Batterers intervention programs are almost always court-ordered after an event has occurred, or sometimes they're ordered through divorce. I don't work in batterers intervention programs. The Julian Center doesn't work in that. However, Service Equality Task Force has identified having those kind of groups as a priority. However, funding for batterers intervention programs is not a lot right now. So we're doing our best with that. However, on the therapy side for survivors, the therapists at Families First and at the Julian Center are trained to work with LGBTQ survivors and their children on their unique barriers, their unique issues, that kind of thing. I don't think that there is a clinical therapy group that I know of for domestic violence survivors that is specific to LGBTQ survivors.
No, the people, the institutions I've worked with, they try their best to integrate both heterosexuals and the community together.
Mm-hmm. Are there, though, and to get to Allie's question, though, with batterers, at least from what I understand about some of this and part of the tragedy of the domestic violence situation is that the abuser often has some significant self-esteem issues himself or herself that then become aggravated by the fact that they're doing things that aren't good to people that they care about, which then means that because they feel bad about themselves, they continue doing the things that make them feel bad. And in this case, what Allie's alluding to here, I think, is that there's another layer to this, that there is a sense of embarrassment or even physical fear that comes with it. How do we go about breaking that dynamic, Chris?
I think it's interesting because we're starting to do research on why perpetrators perpetrate, why abusers abuse. There is always, or at least it seems to be, that there's this sense of abandonment. There's a fear that they're going to lose the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so they start acting abusive, whether that's emotional, physical, what have you, when they believe the relationship is coming to an end. And so that itself is what can keep people who are being victimized in the relationship. They view the abuse as something to overcome with the perpetrator. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, and it shows how thorny this problem is, really, because it is, they talk about a cycle of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And you're right, a lot of our attention is on the people who receive the abuse. Mm-hmm. But that removing them doesn't necessarily solve the problem, because the abuser often can go on to another person, and the cycle continues, or if there are kids in there. We are getting toward the end of the program here, and I want to make sure that people who have been listening and are in this kind of situation know where they can reach out to get help. So, Jenny, real quickly.
The Julian Center has a 24-hour crisis line. Our number is 317-920-9320. Once again, even if you're not ready to leave, even if you just want to talk about your relationship, we can help with that. If you are already out of a relationship and you're being stalked or you're experiencing post-separation violence, we can assist with that. 211, which is local to Central Indiana, can also offer a plethora of resources. DVNconnect.org also has a list of providers that have received this LGBTQ endorsement.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you. I'd like to thank my guests, Chris Hanberg, Jenny Reister, and Sergeant Dawn Higgins, for what has been an illuminating conversation. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.